This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with visual artist Ann Hamilton. She's a distinguished university professor in the Department of Art at Ohio State University. I spoke with her on January 23rd, 2014, at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. Download the MP3 of our show with Ann Hamilton at onbeing.org.
I guess that was for turning on the microphone. Okay, thank you. It's really a pleasure to welcome you all here on a day when Minnesota leads the national newscast for coldest temps in the U.S. And, of course, for us, it's just another day in paradise. And I've really come to mean that. I want to take a quick opportunity to thank the MIA's Affinity Group for Contemporary Art, which helped underwrite this event. We could not possibly present amazing programs like this without this group of generous supporters. And in that regard, I have to mention that there's a related series of programs taking place every Saturday at 3 p.m. from now through April, so pretty much winter. And these sacred salons, as we're calling them, are introductions to a wide range of ideas and practices from spiritual psychology to laughing yoga. So take a jump in. It's free. No reservations are necessary. Just turn up at 3 p.m. And experience what we've also been calling seasonal affect disorder solutions. I am really pleased this evening to introduce two extraordinary individuals, radio host and writer Krista Tippett and artist Ann Hamilton. Each is a leader. Yeah. As you know, each of them is a leader in her own field with multiple acclaims and awards between them, too numerous to list, but a few Guggenheims, MacArthur's, Peabody's, things like that. I'm also really excited that the Institute is being the host to this interview. This program is presented in conjunction with a new exhibition called Sacred, in which hundreds of sacred objects culled by museum curators have been brought together in a series of new installations that explore notions of spirituality and the sacred. The show asks questions like, what is sacred? What has been sacred over time in other cultures, other parts of the world, but especially to us today in a secular world? Although they employ extremely different forms of expression, both Krista and Ann are concerned with those fundamental questions of spirit and being, which are also embodied in great works of art. I'm so grateful to them both for taking this time to be with us here tonight and also for their willingness to have this conversation in a public forum like this. Last thing I'll mention is that I think, depending on how we're doing for time, we can take questions. I'll let you all handle that. And then a final reminder that this program is being recorded for public broadcast, so please be sure to turn off your cell phone. And now please join me in welcoming Krista Tippett and Ann Hamilton.
Well, I just couldn't be happier to be here. I can't remember when Liz and I first started talking about this, but it feels like we talked about it for a while, and then it happened fairly quickly. And I love the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, right? And I've been spending time here, and I especially spent a lot of time here when my children were small. We spent all these Saturdays just traipsing through the hallways here. And my daughter took one of those Saturday morning classes and had one of her pictures framed on the wall. I was so proud. Allie Tippett, age 6. Still in the hallway. So it's a big thrill to be here. And I've, you know, you have, we haven't met before. In fact, we're just now meeting.
This is
literally
live.
Literally laying eyes on each other. Yeah. But you've come up in the show. You and your work have been discussed. And it's been really thrilling these last days to immerse in your work and your writing and your thinking. And I'm probably going to look at my notes more than I usually do because your language is so precise and original and beautiful.
Thank you.
And I want to really work with the way you put words together. Yeah. You know, when I'm... most of my interviews are by ISDN, so coming in through headphones. And when I'm doing that, I can be looking at my notes and it's not disruptive. But here we have physical presence and eye contact and all these great people. So let's just leap in. Oh, and I do want to thank Liz Armstrong, and I want to thank Susan Jacobson before we start. And we will. We'll speak for a little while up here, for maybe 50 minutes, and then open it up for some questions for a little while, and then bring it back up here to close. So you were born in, is it Lima or Lima, Ohio?
Lima.
Lima, Ohio. And you grew up in Columbus. And I wonder if you would just, you know, I think a lot of people speak of you as a spiritual artist or an artist who is in the realm of spirituality. I have to say, I don't really see you claiming that word so often.
Yeah. I mean, I think that word makes me very nervous because I don't actually know exactly what it means. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a word that is, for a lot of people, very loaded and means very particular things.
Right.
And so, you know, I think artists are slippery, that we want to not be categorized, right?
But so if I ask you about, you know, what was the spiritual background of your childhood, in the best, you know, the best connotations you would fill that word with, you know, what do you think of?
Love. Mm. I'm a Calvinist, I think. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm like, I think many of you here are Midwesterners. You know, I certainly grew up going to church with my family, but, you know, it's hard to know sometimes what parts of that you absorb.
Yeah.
I remember my grandmother saying, well, just take the parts you like and don't worry about the rest of it.
I don't think she was a very good Calvinist by the sound of it.
You know, I remember hearing her actually tell stories of earlier generations, which I think were Quaker pacifists. Mm. And even though that wasn't a direct lived experience of my own, I think that I've always held some sense that something passes genetically or, you know, and that maybe I got a little tiny piece of that. Mm. But also I think growing up where, you know, you worked hard and labor was its own reward and you took care of people that you loved. And I grew up in a very tight family. Mm. Yeah.
So here's something you've said. I think I'm putting some words together. But you talk about the tactile experience of words and the tactile experience of things as a space we are always straddling. Mm. And I'd love for you to talk about what you mean by that. And again, like trace, you know, where that awareness, how and when and where that arose in you.
I think I know. I think I was very close with my grandmother. And, you know, I have really distinct bodily memories of sitting next to her on the couch. You know, and you're little and you kind of get in that space under her arm. And her arms were full. And we would knit or needlepoint, and she would read. Mm. And I think there's something about the rhythm of the hands being busy and then your body falls open to absorb and concentrate on what you're listening to, but not completely because you have two concentrations. And then from that, that sort of cultivates a kind of attention that is the rhythm of those two things together. So the unfolding of the voice in space and then the material accreting under your hand. And they have really different satisfactions. You know, but you know, you can see the material. And
she was actually making. She was a maker.
She was a maker.
And she was making sweaters.
Sweaters.
She was making things you wore.
Yeah, or we were needle pointing, or all those lap things, the making by hand, and that was tremendously comforting. Hmm. You know.
Yeah. You also said this lovely thing that textiles are the first house of the body.
Yeah.
The first, what do you say, the body's first extension.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's that question about, like, how do we know things? And that we grow up or we're educated in a world that ascribes a lot of value to those things that we can say or name. Mm-hmm. And but there are all these hundreds of ways that we know things through our skin, which is the largest organ of our body. And so, you know, my first hand is that textile hand. And text and textiles are woven always, experientially for me. And then I think that when I first started making things out of cloth, it was like it was another skin. So I was thinking about it as an animate surface and thinking about it as something that both covers and reveals. Hmm. And
and you also draw out this notion of threads. There's the threads of sewing and threads of ideas,
yeah,
lines of speech,
right,
and the weaving that happens with both words and substances.
Like, yeah, that. And that's ancient. That is like the origins are in those, for the thread pulled from the body in so many cultures, or something across space and time. Like one of the things I was thinking about is, well, what's the relationship between a book and an installation, which is how I usually work, and how, you know, when you're reading a book, you're immersed and you're both inside that book and you're far away in the world that mm-hmm. it might take you to. And the book isn't any one place. You can't say there's the experience. It's across this, the whole space and the duration of that time. And the experience of walking through an installation is that it accretes in you. It isn't like there is the thing. And it's, I think it's that sedimentation or that accretion of experience that where you come to feel, understand maybe what it is that you're walking through. And that the last thing that might happen as it comes up your body is that you might arrive in a way to say or name in some way the nature or quality, maybe the quality of that experience. And how do you stretch the thread, I guess, of that duration long enough that you can trust that seeping up? Yeah.
I feel like there's something, you know, as you said, this is ancient, right? That we mm-hmm. take in things through our body and it's working with our hands and that it's not all just verbal, but
right.
I don't know, I said to somebody recently, I'm trying to think who it was, it's another interview, I feel like Descartes has a lot to answer for. I think it was Eve Ensler.
Oh,
because
mm-hmm.
she's also so much about knowing our bodies and inhabiting our bodies and actually how...
And trusting
that. We got
that
away
knowledge.
From that in Western civilization. We made everything yeah. very cerebral, including spirituality.
Right.
And as you said, I mean, I don't know, the image of your grandmother with her, with the yeah. needlepoint and the knitting sweaters, it's an old art. It feels like a lost art, but it's humanizing when we rediscover these
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's interesting because I teach in a university, and I think about where's the place in that kind of educational institution for embodied knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Embodied knowledge. Embodied I love knowledge. That phrase, yes.
And how do we cultivate that, and how do we trust it? I think it's a big thing. How do we listen to it?
Mm-hmm.
That I think sometimes we're very busy giving... what we know away because we think it doesn't have any authority, or like it's almost like we give our experiences away because we don't know how to trust.
What do you mean? What do you mean that we give them away?
I'm thinking as an artist
yeah.
that when you're making something, you don't know what it is for a really long time, and so you have to kind of cultivate the space around you where you can trust the thing that you can't name. Yeah. And if you feel a little bit insecure or somebody questions you or you need to know what it is, then what happens is you give that thing that you're trying to listen to away. because it doesn't sound important.
You're
trying
to capture it here when it can't be there yet.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so how do you kind of cultivate a space that allows you to dwell in that?
That's another word I love, dwelling.
Yes. Dwell in that not knowing, really, that is actually really smart and can become really articulate, but, you know, like the thread has to come out, and it comes out at its own pace.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to talk some more about the way you join words and materials, right? And, I was just thinking, there was one image, it's actually impossible, I think, to give any kind of summary of your work. Mm-hmm. At one point when I was preparing, I was thinking, because a lot of people will be listening when we do the show. I mean, maybe a lot of people in this room are familiar with your work. Mm-hmm. But when you put it out on public radio, you have to assume, no familiarity to deep familiarity.
Right.
And it's impossible to just give a sentence that says, she works with this kind of object or this kind of installation.
Right.
I am going to, maybe you can tell stories as we go through about particular experiences. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying one of the images, and maybe this is because I'm such a word person, because I suffer from this cerebral disease a little bit. Mm-hmm. the place where you, literally drew out this idea, was it Lineament? Is that the project?
Lineament. Wallace Stevens.
Okay. Yeah. And it was sentences, so threads of thought,
right,
which you actually cut out. I mean, mm-hmm. So it's the physical sentence on a piece of paper, mm-hmm. and then it becomes almost like a ball of yarn.
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay, so that's a great, that will help me. So the books, there were books and they were prepared. So they were cut in such a way that I could join my textile hand to my reading hand. Yeah. And so the lines of text were cut so that if you started in the upper left-hand corner, which is also where you would start reading, you could lift it out as a continuous thread.
Right.
Right? Like this. Okay. And so in being able to do that, the two-dimensional page and the printed page would wind front to back into a ball that was hand-sized. So there was this transformation of 2 to 3 dimension, but also obviously of the word into the scale and hand of the body. Mm-hmm. And then those accumulated. And that sort of act of transformation is, obviously linked to all of the history of relations in some ways between the material and the word.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think partly what you're also asking about the tactile is that, when we want to know something, we reach our hand out to touch it. Like, I don't know that until I touch it like that. And then it's like it's taken in. And so I think I'm looking for processes also that allow that. It's like the process will become embodied, and through that I will begin to understand it, and through that I will then come to words.
And I think it's so important just to note that what you're describing, which in some ways you receive through this lineage, I feel, of your grandmother, right? And then you've run with it as an artist.
Right.
But cutting-edge, science is now showing us that all these things that we've tried to talk about come in through our bodies first.
Right.
Including, the heart, dark side, right? Trauma.
Yeah.
But also our whole experience of the world is never just mental.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or verbal.
Right. And we're supposed to be moving around all the time. So if you need to move, no. But and it's like, and I think the other part of it is that I think about the experience of maybe walking through the museum or taking in experience. It's at the pace of the body moving through space, and that it isn't that we sit and have an idea or that we sit and, ingest things in a certain way. It's that it's through moving in space that something becomes absorbed, mm-hmm. and comes to be felt.
And also what strikes me is you're talking about an experience where we kind of rediscover our wholeness, right? But there's mm-hmm. also this social aspect. I mean, you said it's across space and time,
right?
But it's also in, you know, in the threads of a garment, or mm-hmm. in the words that make a story or a book,
right.
And then in what happens to both of those kinds of objects.
Yeah,
it's also our connection to everyone else,
right? Well, and it's like in a, to go back to the knitting, like in the knitted structure, you can take a sweater or sock and you can see each loop up and around and slip through and up and around and over. And so in that whole that has become, it never loses all the parts that constitute it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's also been, you know, a part of, I don't know, structuring the work in some way where every act of it is in some ways transparently present in the material, and that you can see that.
Mm-hmm. Even as you can see the whole, you can
even
still
as you
see
can it. See the whole, you mm-hmm. can see all the parts, and that we you go back and forth between those.
Oh, so much to talk about. I want here, something you...
Can I
you
say just, something?
Yes, okay. Yes. You can interrupt me anytime.
Can I interrupt you?
This is your conversation.
Well, I wanted to say partly that, like, I'm a radio person. Mm-hmm. We don't have a TV in our house, and it's not because, oh, I'm not going to have a TV. It just hasn't kind of ever arrived, much to my son's chagrin. But I've listened to radio a lot, and so I've been listening to your program for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then the podcast, and the intimacy of the voice, like I feel like you're already my friend.
Yeah.
and the voice coming in and being as I drink tea or I work, and the kind of comfort of that. And I feel like, you know, many of the things that you've talked about in the program have, like, they make a condition within which I can think about certain things going on in my own work.
Mm.
And things that I don't maybe haven't found the language for. Mm-hmm. And I think that partly in work, it's like wanting to keep that kind of intimacy that I experience with a form of radio that is the form you work in. And at the same time, create an experience that is like everybody, all, we, like it's like a condition that allows many, many people to occupy together, even in their kind of aloneness.
Yes.
And so if I think about radio,
yes.
I think, you know, that someone else is hearing that in the same intimate way. And so I'm also joined to all those people.
Yeah.
And there's something about seeking the quality of that experience mm-hmm. that seems very important.
Yes, I think it can be intensely individual and intensely communal
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah.
But I think what you have helped me think about is just now is, you know, working with the voice alone.
Yeah.
Is really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the experience of. I'm not having this experience now, okay? But I've had the experience. I've had the experience of being physically with someone.
Yeah.
And you're taking in so much when you're physically with someone. There's so much more happening than the conversation. There's eye contact. There's body yeah. language. There's the physical experience of the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I often find, you know, I have to sit up straight. I have to dress up, right? Whereas if I'm in the studio at work, I can have my eyes closed and right.
Yeah.
And so there's something I really come to love this discipline of just because, you know, when I'm doing the ISDN, it's just the voice, and that's
yeah.
all the listener is going to get.
Right.
But that's not disembodied, right?
No.
So I mean, I think what you've been helping me get is that radio, which is working with the voice,
right.
is a beautiful concentration of mm-hmm. this idea of how words and language and ideas and the body. I mean, it's embodied knowledge, right? It's embodied conversation.
I think it's a friend of mine who's a wonderful poet, Susan Stewart, said that hearing is how we touch at a distance.
Mm.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. That's why we need our poets.
Yeah.
And so how, you know, how our I guess in some ways for me, what one of the questions is, how do you make the condition for tactile experience, which isn't literally always touching?
Yeah.
You know, and,
right.
And or like it can be visual, but how is that felt? And, you know, that's kind of a form thing that's always really a challenge in every situation. But I think just as like listening to the radio, and I can listen and wander around in several thoughts
kind of
at
like
the same time.
Knitting with your grandmother,
yeah.
And telling stories.
It's like, yeah. I hope you don't mind. Like I'm also doing other things, but but I think that's also how I start projects is in some ways just to try to listen. And what is the form of that listening for what something needs to become, mm-hmm. or to find the question, or, you know, listening is obviously a very specific thing in a conversation, but also as a practice, for me, because I respond to spaces, the first architecture maybe is the coat, but then the next one is this building around us, and the felt quality of that already has all this, as you say, information in it. And so it's like, what is it that is here that maybe asks a question or that can be brought forward?
You're listening to the space.
You're listening, yeah.
Yeah. It's also, it's so true that it's, I also think listening is something we really have to practice because it's our everyday spaces are not set up for listening. It's almost something you have to
it's like say,
create
now I'm
the space to do mm-hmm. and the intention to do.
Or we're plugged in, you know.
Like right.
It's very funny. It's very hard for me to wear headphones at all or sunglasses because then I feel like I'm not where I am, wherever that is. Mm-hmm. I'm not here. And, you know, there's some filter going on. But it's also how do you listen to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how do you trust the...
Which we're also not necessarily good at.
Yeah, we override that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is related. I want to ask you something that intrigues me about your artistic process. So you've talked about how when you approach a new project, you get fully absorbed, fully immersed...
Fully afraid.
Okay, I don't think you wrote that. And here's what you wrote. Particularity becomes abstraction. And I that really intrigued me because where that took me is something I think a lot about is how in terms of in narrative, in storytelling or conversation,
mm-hmm.
There's something magical and paradoxical about the more particular and vivid the word you can put, more particularly and vividly you can put words around your experience, the mm-hmm. more it can actually become a story that is universal, that mm-hmm. other people can hear and translate into their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard you talking about particularity becoming abstraction,
mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you would tell a story about, you know, and then obviously it goes from there. And then I think you said you stop seeing and then you start to see again and then you see what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell a story about a project and that mm-hmm. process, those places?
I mean, I can think of one kind of early project where maybe it's really very specific. I was doing a project at the Diaz Center for the Arts in New York, which is in Chelsea, which since then has become a large, you know, art community of galleries and stuff, but at the time was not. And I remember walking around the space, and it was empty, and it's a industrial space in New York, and I remember hearing an ice cream truck at a distance, like in the neighborhood. And it was not really a neighborhood of kids, so that was anomalous. But hearing that but not being able to locate it. And so walking to the window, putting my hand out to touch the window, and then from that thinking about how the sound turned me. Like there was an internal response to this external stimuli, just like a plant growing towards light. And so that very particular thing, experience, became the Project Tropos, which is an internal response to an external stimuli. But it's also, as Natalie Serrault writes about, that it's like these, you prepare yourself internally to speak. And can you, and that reaching one's hand out is that preparation. And so, or maybe a kind of liminal space. So as the project formed, which became this kind of oceanic landscape of the tail hair from horses, and had a single person sitting reading in it with a hot stylus that burned the words away, I was thinking about the impulse to write, the impulse to connect to another person is, you know, through this social interaction of something coming in. But it started with the ice cream truck. Did you follow that?
Yeah.
And so, but I was seeking the more abstract relationship in that particular moment. Mm-hmm. And then, so I worked with an actor, Tom Curlew, who had had a stroke and had aphasia. And so I asked him to read for me from a couple of different texts that he helped select. What was really interesting for me is, of course, that he can read the words completely, but the words that he's reading are not necessarily the words that would come out of his mouth. And so what you heard is you heard the effort to come to speech. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't what he was saying. It was this process of trying to draw something up out of the body. And we placed that around the perimeter of the room outside the windows, which were changed out for semi-transparent glass, so you couldn't see out. And so as you would walk towards the window, that voice would move to the next speaker. So it was always, the voice was just always ever out of reach. Yeah. And meanwhile, your ankles and your feet were caught up in this landscape of hair, which carries the cellular memory of the animal. Uh-huh. And so while you're immersed in at your feet, you're following this thing that you can't quite hold on to. And I think it's that in-between space that I was quite interested in. The kind of like the book, the lineament book that we talked about earlier, that as the reader read with a hot stylus that became smoke, that was reabsorbed by the material of the floor. So
words
became matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so those are particular materially, but also larger and more abstract relations. But how they're particular is what makes the abstraction possible.
Right.
I think.
It's mysterious.
Yeah. And then you wonder, well, is it just because that's how I describe it to myself? You know, that maybe no one else experiences it like that.
I do want you to tell the story of one of the early projects you did, maybe a first project when you were a student, about where you had a suit covered in toothpicks, mm-hmm. made of, which actually, when you look at the picture, you kind of look like Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Why was that important for you? Because you said that was a really important project.
That's a really great question. What Chris is describing is a man suit that I covered with thousands of individual toothpicks that have been painted black with little white tips. So I made a hide that
and
I could
it doesn't
put on.
I mean, the photos I said, it doesn't look like toothpicks. It looks like
like porcupine,
yes,
sort of thing. And I was in graduate school then, and I was incredibly self-conscious. You know, you're really worried about is it good? There's a lot of pressure to articulate. You kind of leave behind, I think, when you go to graduate school, a lot of things that you've shored up a tiny bit of confidence with. And so, and I had made a project, maybe this is important to know, that was in my first critique in graduate school, and it was an awful project. It was really, really bad. But I had all sorts of words that I could put with, like, why I had done it all. And then I just, and I realized that that wasn't what I really cared about. And so I thought, is there a way to take this kind of physical, or the maybe emotional predicament, or the self-consciousness, and find a physical form for that? And in inhabiting it, does it then change my relationship to that fear, or to that self-consciousness?
So the suit represented how you felt, which was all spiny and conspicuous.
Right. Yes.
And that's really interesting.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's almost like if I can be in it, then it's like, how does your own vulnerability, like, then become a place of incredible strength? Mm. Mm. And that if you can just occupy that, then there's a whole lot of knowledge in there. Yeah. Mm.
That makes me think of something that's disconnected, but it was just on my mind. Somebody I interviewed years ago, Jean Vanier, who created these communities around the world that are centered around people with mental disabilities.
Yes.
And he talked about the reason he believes that so many of us are so uncomfortable with people with disabilities, that we all walk around all the time, you know, trying to hide whatever's wrong with us or whatever we think is wrong with us, and that people who have who carry their flaws on the outside are terrifying.
Right.
Because we spend so much energy trying to keep that to ourselves.
Yeah, I think when I first started teaching, my students called it the public humiliation class. No. And it wasn't that it was so humiliating. It was really that, like, I was asking them to do things in public that were about taking a risk, you know, and that if you can do that, if you can let yourself fail, if you can let yourself be really bad, if you can take the risk.
Or just look awkward on purpose.
Look awkward. Then you can do a whole lot of other things after that. Yeah.
Something that also is really intriguing to me is how you talk about using time. Time itself as a process and a material. Can you say some more about that?
I think in some ways, I don't know the best way to say that, but that, like everybody, you know, our lives are really, really busy, and we're fragmented in many ways. And I think that within the work, I try to make time for those things that, in some ways, it's hard for me to maybe make time for in my daily life. So if I can say I'm going to read out loud for 6 hours in the context of a project, then I can give myself the time and space to do that in a way that it's hard outside of the work, maybe sometimes. But maybe more, how is it a material? It's a, I think, the long duration of the works, I'm asking you to enter the time of the work and to spend as much time as you kind of want to give to it. So in the project last year at the Armory, which was a really large project, and it had a whole rhythm to the day, that I was there every day, all day, learning what it was. And I understood that it was really important for me to spend all that time to actually come to understand it. And it was interesting to then be joined, I think, by other people in the time there. I don't think this really answers your question, but...
Well, but what you're getting at is how I think so many of us in our lives now, we... it's kind of like we receive time as kind of a bully, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all about deadlines, and which we're not meeting.
We never.
Yeah.
We're only at the last minute.
And all the things we can't get to do. So yeah. we kind of receive time passively. And, of course, the physicists tell us that our whole sense of time is completely illusory. We don't get it. We can't internalize what it really is anyway. And so what you're talking about is actually kind of claiming time as a thing that you're grappling with and also working with, and actually, I mean, you're kind of insisting that it be more generous.
Yeah, and I think that in many ways it's like, how do you let things take the time they actually need? It seems like this whole efficiency thing is really doesn't work very well, because in fact there's this thinking that's always going on inside the thing that you're engaged with, and you're not really having the experience if you're rushing off to the next thing, right? So even when you're really, really compressed for time, how do you cultivate just being in the time you have at that moment? Mm-hmm. And how do you, how can you just be present, even if it's like, you know, a few minutes?
Mm-hmm. Which is a spiritual discipline, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
But you're, I mean, it's a practical discipline, too.
It's practical.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's practical, definitely. And I think the other thing is that we assign so much value to being busy. You know, we wear busyness as a kind of badge like what we're doing is necessary in some way. But it's like we're the one that invents that. And so how do you kind of push things off as long as possible? And I think even in my process, that I wait as long as possible to say what something's going to be. You know, I try to suspend all the possibilities till the very last moment, because I know that what something needs to become needs all of that time. Mm-hmm. And that maybe an institution or Liz is asking for, I don't know, somebody may ask for, you know, you have to write a press release, or you need a title because something's going to be public and there are real deadlines for that. And so instead of getting scared by that, how do you find a way to acknowledge what you know but also what you don't know, so that you can suspend that process as long as possible? And I think part of making work live is to continue that process into the public life of the work. Mm-hmm. So there's a process you have that's maybe behind the scenes that brings you to a certain point. But then when something opens, it isn't a done thing that's finished. It's this thing that's now just opening to something completely different. And so you also need the time to take that relationship and understand what that is. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, the times when I've maybe opened a project and been whisked away to something else, it's really unsatisfying. I didn't learn from it.
That's, again, it's an expression of this, this, I would say, reverence almost that you have for embodied knowledge, that you let it, that you let the knowledge find expression everywhere before you, that the words are the last thing that comes. Because I guess maybe when you put words to it, does it start to shut it down? It starts to define it.
But I'm full of contradictions. Because I think on the other hand, it's finding the word that you need is also really part of opening it up. So on the one hand, suspension, and on the other hand, reading voraciously and finding the poets or something you hear, mm-hmm. The word that you pull out of the newspaper, that in another way, the process of moving towards the tangible and tactile is also needs those words to grow it. And so it's kind of both at the same time. You know, I think that when I'm reading, I feel like reading is a huge part of my studio. Not that I read in the studio, but the page is the studio. And there'll be just, you know, those two words that are side by side in a particular way that are the very thing you need to understand something that was less articulate, maybe, or not worded before that. And that when I find those words or those things that I need to read, they make a landscape, I think a landscape of permission around the process. So it's always both.
So they are boundaries and anchors for words.
Yeah, and it's how
but
we...
But you're saying not to rush that, because they're boundaries and anchors, you have to be really careful with them.
It's how we do everything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, like how... It's like a word can... the way something is named or categorized can actually really open something up, or it can close something down. So it's how you use it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your relationship with technology. I mean, you said you don't have a TV, but you've done digital prints.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I think you also said some interesting things about, you know, technology amplifying human presence at a distance, which can be, like all of this, it can be dark and light.
I mean, I think, you know, the incredible thing about technology is it amplifies and extends our reach, the reach of a voice, greater than the reach of one's touch. But so I think one of my questions has been, what is the value or form of making by hand or making at the pace of the body,
right,
when we live in this technologically extended time? And so I think that, fortunately I have a lot of great help in the studio that helps me with that technology. I know that there's like an analog digital joint that is really particular and changing constantly. Mm-hmm. And the nature of that joint allows certain kind of images to be made. Certain quality of imagery is particular to like how a lens sees in this kind of camera, generation of camera. And I think those are part of my materials. It's kind of this joint.
You could almost say, what was it? What was this phrase of yours that that textiles are the first house of the body, and then you said physical space is the second house, and there's a way in which these virtual spaces we inhabit are a new piece of architecture for our lives.
Well, and so partly it's like, so how is that tactile, you
yeah.
know, and how, where is the, and what's the nature of the we in that?
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really done like a online project particularly, but, you know, I think about, I spend tons of time on my computer and I do a ton of research on it, and what I can find is extraordinary.
Yes.
And I wouldn't ever want to lose that.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove.
And on the other hand, I'm scissors and glue and scotch tape and whatever. And so that it's more like, how do you balance the screen and what it makes possible with, which is often the far away with the kind of close at hand. But, you know, that's also, there's a generation that's growing up thinking inside the technology
mm-hmm.
in a way that, you know, isn't my generation.
Right, for whom it really is a house in a way that it's never going to be a house
yeah.
for someone who was 40 when it came along.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts with the artist Ann Hamilton. Let's just talk for a few more minutes, and then we'll open this up. So much I want to talk to you about. Oh, all right. So tell us about your pinhole camera.
So everybody knows what a pinhole camera
no,
is.
No, you have to explain it.
Oh, I do? Okay.
Yes.
So a pinhole camera, I guess it's like the radio. I mean, it's magic. And it's
okay, it's crystal clear now.
So it's a dark box with a tiny little hole in it, and the light that goes through that hole makes an image on the back of the box. And so it's the first camera. Well, maybe not the first camera, but it's the one of the very earliest way of making an image. And so I started a project where I made pinhole cameras that were very small, that would fit inside the cavity of my mouth. And I started thinking about my mouth as a room because, you know, unlike other senses, that those are objects, but the mouth is a space. And I became interested in thinking about what happens when one sense is displaced to another part of the body. So if the sense of sight is joined to the place of voice, what results from that? And so the pinhole camera opened, and then my lips, when they opened, are like the shutter of the camera. But also it's like one of those putting oneself in the context of something slightly embarrassing. So when I opened my mouth, that I'm standing face to face, very close to another person. And so the pinhole is registering the nature of that face to face exchange without the apparatus of the camera, but with my open mouth. And so in some ways it makes a condition to be photographed that's not like being photographed. And maybe the image is the trace of that exchange. I mean, there's so many layers for me in that, because also if you're standing very close to someone you don't really know and your mouth is open, yeah, it's very intimate, right? Yeah. But you can see yourself in the pupil of the eye, oh, of the person that you're facing. And I think the pupil, I think the origin of that is the little puppet in the eye. And so you see yourself upside down in someone else's eye. Hmm. And so it's really about like how this makes a context or condition for the exchange of that sort of odd intimacy. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a long time. I had a little Tupperware box, and I would travel until it got too complicated with the airport security. And no, but it was because it allowed something social to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And I looked at pictures of you. With people taking pictures of them. And it's right. I mean, it was playful.
Yeah.
Right? It couldn't help but be playful, and there was laughter because what are we all told? Well, you know, don't close your mouth.
Close your mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's that way about, like, how do you set up a situation where something can happen, but you're not controlling what mm-hmm. happens? Mm-hmm. But it has the consequences that have everything to do with what's made. You know, so you're making a circumstance, but not directing it in some way.
And when I interviewed Meredith Monk, mm-hmm. who's a wonderful, again, vocalist, artist, performance artist, and you've done some fabulous work with her. Mm-hmm. I remember her, and this is related to, I mean, this is these different, well, the project that you did together called Mercy mm-hmm. also had this relationship between the mouth and the hand.
Right.
Again, joining those different
senses. The first extensions.
Yeah, and she told a story about... why don't you tell that story about how you both together saw a story of a father and a son who were both shot at the Israeli-Palestinian border by both sides. Mm-hmm. These people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time in a tragic way. And Meredith talked about how you realize that you can... A hand can hold a trigger. A hand can reach out to touch someone.
Right, right. I mean, I think with that project, which was called Mercy, it was about thinking about how do we, in some sense, inhabit the agency of what we can do with all the possibilities of the hand and mouth. And we made, I think at one point in that project, I mean, certainly we were responding politically, and to the newspaper comes in every day, and that becomes part of your landscape of response, what's happening in the world. And how can your small act, singular act of making have any consequence? And so the only thing you can do is think about the consequence of your immediate extension and how you do that. And so we made a list, actually, at one point, I think, of all the things the hand can do and all of the kind of appetites and qualities of what the voice can do, and that those are actions, and that how are those our material. And that didn't necessarily structure the performance in any way, but it was... The conversation partly behind that, and how do we own that? How do we own that?
Mm-hmm.
Wear it. I'm always. Is that partly what you're?
Yeah.
I mean, a little bit like.
Yeah, it made me think of. I was in Israel for the first time a couple of years ago, and we were going to the Wailing Wall, which, you know, I think I wanted to be overtaken by a sense of mystery and God's presence, and I was, in fact, was irritated by the separation of the genders, and it was mm-hmm. hot, you know, it was touristy and
right.
gimmicky, but when I, have you been there? You walk up to the wall, and here's the
yeah.
thing, to me, it wasn't even the prayer that made it incredibly powerful. It was putting my hands on that wall and thinking of all the
hands.
All the hands.
Right, and that you're joining those.
Yes, and that felt sacred.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And I think we're trying to, you know, in many ways, like trying to find opportunities in which we can have that experience. And we can feel our own presence, gesture, whatever, in relationship to that much larger one across time and space and cultures. And so, you know, as a artist working in a contemporary context, it's like, how can we create a circumstance in which those kinds of processes of joining and acknowledgement can occur? And I'm in abstraction again, right?
Here's something you said also that is related to this. It's a beautiful thought, and I have to like sit with it. The body, through physical labor, leaves a transparent presence in material, and labor is a way of knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm always going through this museum, attracted to those things where you feel the presence in some way or another, the evidence in the material of the body. So the worn steps that are in a marble staircase, the way you feel a handrail when you go up, that consciously or unconsciously your body is aware of those things. And you know, one of my studios, I think partly, is going to the flea market, and it's partly you're blank. I'm blank, and I'm just looking at where my attention falls, and it's to this odd sort of disparate category of objects. But in some ways, what connects all of them is that there's some evidence of someone else's body in that object. Mm. And, you know, we're in a museum that is full of that.
Yes, again, that
and
just
this recognition
is a way to talk about what is so special about a museum.
Yeah. Well, and that you fall open to those things. And even if you don't know its history or you don't know where it's from and you can't place it in time, there's still this recognition that is, like, very strong. And that recognition makes you curious and makes you fall open. And when you fall open to it, then your heart falls open, right? And anything is possible.
Let's have a conversation with you. I don't know how this is working. Are there some microphones, I believe? Let's see. I don't know. There are. Walk up to the microphone. All right, so we'll just talk. I'll ask another question, and then we'll start this. Oh, so this place, the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, has a sacred exhibit now, and this conversation we're having is part of this event, this sacred event. Spirituality is not a word you love. Is sacred a word that speaks to you? What does that word mean?
I think sacred is a bigger word, and so I feel more comfortable with it. I think one of the things is that so many of the amazing objects and pieces, old and new, in that exhibition, many of them, you know, they come from a living context that had a spiritual or sacred intent. And house, right? And that we've taken those things, so many things in this whole museum, not just in that show, that was their original context. And they had a meaning because they had a function, they had a use, they had a place in a ritual. And that here they're very much removed from that, just as we are, I think, very removed from access to maybe those rituals in our own life. Mm-hmm. And so, in some ways, like, you can't ever recreate that context that things have been taken out of, but what is it that can happen here? And, you know, I think about how many people, we're walking around the galleries tonight, or when you, I don't know, go in the Met in New York, another incredible encyclopedic museum, that we want to be there. We want to stand in front of these things. They remind us of something, that they speak to something that we need to feel. And it's very alive to us and necessary. But it's not returning those. It's like, how do they have a contemporary life that's in a very different context? And so, you know, I think that's something museums everywhere are really grappling with in a lot of ways, and thinking mm-hmm. about how do these things become animate to the time that we're in and meaningful across. They carry all that history, but they are now in a very different context, mm-hmm. and they satisfy a different, or maybe the same longing, but differently.
There's some similarity between, the atmosphere of explicitly sacred places and the atmosphere in a museum, right? I mean, how many spaces in this culture do we stand silently
mm-hmm. yeah,
and just take something in and soak in beauty and be in awe of that?
Well, I think when you go through the doors, like when if you go through the doors of a church, you know, you enter that threshold and it's a different space,
yeah.
and the air is different and it's maybe more quiet.
Time is different, I think, too.
You're willing to just sit and be. And I think that we come needing that a lot to the museums, very mm-hmm. much so.
Mm. Never thought about that before.
And I think also as an artist, you know, I'm very... I think one of the questions that is behind a lot of the things I'm working on is, well, where is it that we can gather and kind of be alone together? And there's so much, as we all know, us, them. And, what are the circumstances for we that I can enjoy the pleasure of something I'm seeing here, knowing that I'm also sharing that with a person next to me? And there's a interesting kind of intimacy with this total stranger that this situation makes possible. And that can change your whole day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's another one of those experiences, like we were talking about radio. I mean, it's communal and individual at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that alone
and
together...
And that art is like that too, yes.
That maybe too much together makes us really nervous. But the alone together is something that I think we're trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today I'm at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts with the artist Ann Hamilton. Or I should say the maker, Ann Hamilton. Because we haven't talked about that. That's the word you prefer to artist.
Yeah.
Come on. Does nobody have a question or a comment? Oh, back there. All right. Yes.
Hi, my name's Matt. I really appreciate the conversation and being able to be a part of it just through the listening process. As an architect, I also appreciate the idea of kind of our body being housed and that happening at kind of a number of levels and how that affects us. So all of that being said, I am curious how you as a teacher and as an artist deal with vulnerability when it comes to the process of making, and kind of how much of yourself or how much of your students do you encourage to kind of just really throw out there for, you know, whatever it means to throw things out there?
Well, I think that as a teacher, you try to make a place that's both rigorous and is pushing on one hand and safe on the other, you know. And how do you cultivate a conversation, you know, among the peers where they're both supportive and they're also, you know, very critical? And, you know, I think that's different in kind of every circumstance. But is that what that... What's so nervous-making about what if? And so if you can cultivate the, like, what-if attitude, then there's not too much weight put on any singular attempt to address it. And that, or it's like, well, many of my students right now are in the middle of getting ready to put their MFA thesis show up. And it's very nervous-making because all of a sudden some of the confidence that you've accrued is, like, draining out of you. Is it, you're getting ready to be public. And it's like, how do you continue to... it's just your next project. And you know, if you can't fail, if that judgmental part of you starts kicking in and stopping you from or making you paralyzed, then you actually can't ever make your next piece. And so, you know, it's really, as a teacher, you know, it's trying to cultivate a landscape of permission for the students to fail.
Many of Krista's questions and your responses reminded me of a beautiful installation piece of yours that was at Mass MoCA that was in a space that actually looked quite cathedral-like. And I was thinking of your question about time as a material as one of them, and then your comment about as you walk through a piece, how your experience of it is embodied. And it had pieces of paper coming out of, I don't remember the name of it. I feel like there maybe was something about text and absence of text, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And then there was a balcony that actually had pews in it of some kind, but I wondered if you could just say more about that piece in the context of this discussion. And what was it called?
It was called Corpus, and it was at Mass MoCA, and it was a huge old industrial space where they had once manufactured capacitors which store energy and then release it, and it also had been a textile factory where they had dyed, and so dyed cloth. And so, it had once been the room that you're describing with the, there were many mechanisms that were powered by air that were dropping single sheets of white paper to the ground from like 30 feet. And there was a rhythm to that, like that you could hear the air kind of like breath. And I think... What was very interesting to me about this, that project that maybe has some bearing here, is that I realized that maybe the central material of the work in some ways was you as the figure walking through it, and that a piece of paper might draw your attention because it catches the light, or a recorded voice raising and lowering from a set of bell-shaped speakers might draw your attention because it pulls you this way in this enormous landscape of this old industrial architecture. And that the pattern of how you were turned by the elements in the three parts of the exhibition actually completed themselves in you. And I think that that actually opened my work up for me a lot, and made me perhaps help me understand and articulate a little bit that the piece is not about defining the nature of that experience, but making a condition within which you can wander around and pay attention to the things that your attention is drawn to, and in that grows the project.
And what were the pews?
They were very heavy, large timbers that had actually been the timbers that were the beams that divided the two floors originally of that two-story space. And they were in another part of the building. And so we used those to make a whole series of benches that were white and were stacked up on the second floor in the balcony, but which were unoccupied. Maybe occupied at times by people. And I think in many ways that pew there, and there was a spinning video that would sometimes catch the light of the, or catch the papers falling. And I think in many ways it's the longing a longing to congregate, a longing to sit together with other people that are different from me, and to make some shared experience. And I think that, you know, I'm not, I don't go to church. I don't have a place where I have that place of congregation. And I think I'm looking for what the form of that can be. And how that can happen. You know, I'm really attracted to Quaker meeting halls, and there's the thing that just puts me on edge is shape note singing, and how everyone sits, you're in a square, you know, facing each other, and one person is calling, but who's calling, the song passes from person to person. And how does perhaps making that circumstance become part of what I can do through the work?
I kept thinking when I was reading about how you approach your work and uh-huh. objects and placement and this word attention, you just use the word attention, yeah. of this beautiful definition of prayer by Simone Weil. Mm-hmm. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer.
Mm. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'll take that.
Yeah. I wanted to return to the space where you were talking about the tension and between not grasping at labels but also not suppressing words as they arise. Mm-hmm. And offer the comment that what is wonderful to me about the realm of art is that words are never irrevocable. They can always be overwritten in the next piece, the next poem, the next thought, so that, you know, one's art becomes a sort of endless chain of substitutions. So for me, I don't find that language fixes me. Mm-hmm. It's always mutable.
Right.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Well, I think maybe in some ways that I'm learning to also see that, like, you know, some of the earlier work that was, you know, maybe in some ways more of a refusal of how I perceive the relationship between language and material, you know, has really shifted, and language is much, much more central to the work. And I, you know, luxuriate in it. And it's more about the joints between and the nature of that, and how literature and what poetry and what our ability to language our experience makes possible as one form of knowing that is always in hand with touching and the, you know, history of materials, and that, you know, that, like, we're looking at these incredible knit pieces in the museum, and, you know, knowing that they, if it's out of silk, it carries the animal, and it has embedded in that materiality is all of this kind of cultural history that is present there if you can recognize it. And how do you bring that recognition to the surface? And that's partly through words. Yeah.
I think the question made me wonder if, is there an implication that words are more problematic, more irrevocable, or less irrevocable in ordinary life than they are in art? Is it harder to take words back in everyday life?
Well, they can sting sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's like the danger here is making any hierarchy at all, really. It's more like we don't want to privilege one kind of experience over another. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in this, like, seesaw thing of trying to, of all of, we need all of it. We need everything to understand where we are, what we can do, what are the questions.
Yeah. I read something when I was preparing that it was from the New York Times. It was 1999, which is another century, but I mean a long time ago. But it was about an installation you did called Mayen.
I don't even know how to say it myself.
I didn't either. Okay,
it's Greek.
Apparently the Greek root of the word mystery. Anyway, you said something about this is what the Times said, that it was about how we know what we know and what we blind ourselves to, how the invisible affects us and how the visible can be veiled. And it's such a wonderful image, and we don't have time to go into it, so we'll just let it sit there. But you said, I'm thinking, this is 1999, that I am the American representative, and it's the eve of the millennium. I want to bring to the surface the questions we should be asking. That's so intriguing to me, and I guess I'm wondering what questions you think we should be asking now, here, in this young, tumultuous, you know, amazing century.
Well, how to be together. I mean, isn't that, that seems like the biggest question, you know, and how to be together. You know, I think that every project, in some ways, it forms by maybe feeling that I have the right question for it. And everything else is kind of debris until I can kind of get to that. And it's usually kind of just a large general question like that. But the circumstance is what makes it particular. So maybe not to talk about the American Pavilion, but to talk about the Armory a little, just maybe as a interesting place to arrive, is that it's a civic building. And so it's a over 100 years old, and it's had all manner of civic gatherings. So what is the civic now seems so huge and so important, and something for us to make together.
Was there one more question? I don't know where the... I can't see where the microphone is.
Yeah, there's one right here.
Okay, let's do one more question.
Well, for so many of us here who are makers and teachers and perhaps also parents, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to how those things inform each other in your life and also how you keep the maker part of you alive with enough time and enough nourishment to not feel like you're always clawing at the small amount of time or space in your head that you have.
I sense something.
Tiny bit of desperation, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm just saying, maybe.
Well, I think when my son was born, you know, I think I just had to learn how to make differently. You know, it happens in your kitchen, and that it just happens differently. And I think there was a process of trusting that just because you can't be in whatever studio, whatever you call your studio, doesn't mean that you're not having a thought or insight or something. And I think it's that if I conceive of them as being separate, then I will be forever frustrated. But if they're all one practice, and every project is, and all the projects are one big project, then I think I, you know, not that we don't feel pressed for time in some ways, but then there's an anxiousness that I can at least allay a little bit. You know, sometimes the most important thing you need to do is, like, make the soup. And and in the soup is going to be the project, even though, you know, a kid is sick upstairs, and that's why you're making the soup or whatever. And, you know, I learn, and I, like in teaching, I learn a lot from my students. And I think that it's reciprocal. It's like everything is reciprocal, and everything feeds everything else. And, you know, it's like how, it's like your attitude has to change to be able to allow yourself to see it like that. But in the end, there's also only so much time. So it's also, I think, particularly as a woman, not feeling guilty for saying, no, I can't do that. I can't do one more thing. And I'm not really great at that. I'm learning. also, I think one of the hardest things is to recognize one's limits and be okay with that instead of, like, judging that.
Judging yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I can't be the super person that I would like to be. And that's listening, you know.
You do like this language of being a maker,
mm-hmm,
I think,
very much.
As much or maybe more than being called an artist. And
yeah.
And it's just occurring to me that that language lends itself to the rest of us, too. I mean, being an artist is specialized, but it's thinking about making as something we all do, each in our own ways,
mm-hmm.
including in our family lives.
And there's so many forms for making. I mean, I've said this before, but I'd like to say it again.
Yeah.
Is that in the, like, I love reading the dictionary. And the Oxford English Dictionary has, I don't know how many pages devoted to make and making and all of its possibilities. And I think that's like making, it's the same as like making a list of all the materials that exist in the world that you might transform in some way. And it's like if you make that list and you take the list of all the possibilities of what making is, like that can just keep you busy forever.
But and you never even get around to the making.
Yeah, but it makes you feel like it's like you see the possibilities. Like we get blinded to the possibilities that we actually have. And I think that's... So you have these little tricks that you do with... You play with yourself to see those. Everybody should try that one.
The list.
The list,
I'm
yeah.
also pretty intrigued by the idea of reading the dictionary. I never thought of that.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. I believe you. I just had never thought of it before.
Yeah. Well, and it's because like, it's just as materials obviously carry histories of the animal or the technologies that made them or where they came from in the earth, that words also carry all of those histories.
Yeah.
And although that's not my area, there's a reason certain words work, and it's because of the histories that they carry for us.
Mm-hmm.
So... lifting that to the surface is of recognition is important.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so you now live in Columbus again, is that right? In
mm-hmm.
Ohio. And
yeah.
I don't know, someplace you were talking about, this is another interview, my life is busy, I travel a lot, but within that my life is very domestic. You're married, you have a son, you have a cat and a dog.
mm-hmm.
You live in an American neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And but as an artist, as a maker, as a professional maker,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're exotic, right? You're doing things that are very original and out there. And
mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about, I wonder how you interact with your neighbors in your ordinary American neighborhood in Ohio. Like,
they don't think I'm exotic.
Right. But how do you think about talking to them about, you know, like something like the exhibit you're doing at the Armory or the Tower in California or the meditation boat in Laos? I mean, or wading through paper and, you know, about how that is connected to this very common longing,
uh-huh.
You know, that's come through again and again of just, you know,
right.
who are we now and
yeah.
what are we to each other?
Yeah. Well, I'm really lucky to live someplace where my neighbors are friends. You know, and I've been there now a long time. You know, I've been there since the early 90s. And so, for instance, down the street are two friends who are both singers. And although their day jobs are different than that, you know, when I started to work on the Armory, I talked to them a lot about voice. And I go hear them, and I learn from them. And they help me trust what I'm doing. And they contribute to it a lot. And I had the most amazing conversation a few nights ago with my neighbor who has just moved in, who's a sophomore and has moved from China to go to school at OSU, where I teach. And he had been to an art event at the Wexner Center, and it had been a music concert with live mixing of video. And it was such an intense experience for him. He didn't know what to do with it.
The
experience of the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came next door. It's like 11 o'clock at night. And he came over to bring me my cat back, who goes and lives in his house when we're out. And it's cold out. And he came over and we talked for probably 2 hours about how he felt. And he didn't know what to call this thing. And he said, I kept, I, w- I he said it made me feel things I didn't know how to process, and it was really scary. And
so it was the effect that this art was having.
And is this the new art?
Uh-huh.
And that was a long conversation.
And what did you tell him?
Well, I listened mostly, mm-hmm. you know, but I think mm-hmm. it was partly about how did he even think about what the nature of that experience was, mm-hmm. and how amazing it was that he allowed himself, again, to be vulnerable enough to be open to this thing that was kind of overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And that he kept talking about how it felt on his skin.
How the experience of watching felt on his skin?
Yes.
He was speaking your language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so he's a new neighbor. Yeah. And, you know, I think that I know when you look at the projects when they're finished or from afar, you know, they look sometimes enormous, and they are in enormous spaces, or they happened over a long period of time. But it's really one tiny little step after another, and it's an associational process. And pretty soon, you know, they arrive like a sweater being knitted into this larger thing. And and it's there's something actually kind of very practical about it, and very mundane, and really, you know, ordinary. I mean, I'm a, I know, it's like there's a pragmatism in it mm-hmm. that I think is really part of how I get there. And on the other hand, I love huge volumes of space. Like being in a gigantic space is something that, you know, it's like you feel it here. And so on the one hand, there's this really practical step. And on the other hand, it's like, you know, it's like wanting to fling yourself into something that's gigantic and will absorb you, and it's kind of scary.
Mm. I mean, even transcendent in a way that it transcends all those pragmatic steps mm-hmm. along the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And together, too, yeah.
Okay. Anne Hamilton, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been really delightful. Mm-hmm. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.